I call this meeting of the Community and Regional Affairs to order. It is now 8 a.m. Tuesday, March 2024, Ashley Johnson Bar Day in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative Baker, Representative McKay, Representative Mears, Representative Ruffridge, Representative Himshut, Vice Chair McCabe, and myself, Representative McCormick. Let the record reflect that we have quorum to conduct business. I would like to thank Sophia Tenney, the committee secretary from records, and Zach Lawhorn from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Please just make sure that your phone is not on, because I will embarrass you if it goes off. Before we got started today, I just wanted to afford Representative Baker the floor to make some remarks, as it is actually Johnson Bar Day, and I just thought it would be important for us to just recognize that. So, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to all those in the room, those online, I just wanted to take a moment to recognize that today is March 12th, 2024, which is Ashley Johnson Bar Day. For those not aware, Ashley Johnson Bar was a little girl from Kotzebue who unfortunately lost her life. She was abducted and mistreated in some of the most horrible ways possible, and the whole community turned out looking for her, and she was eventually found after she had passed. And so in honor of her day, I ask that anyone who has the opportunity wear something purple. It was her favorite color. She was a little girl who we lost far too young and is just one of many who we have lost to the MMIP crisis. So there's some flyers that were distributed to everybody's mailboxes here in the Capitol, recognizing that, and just take a moment to appreciate who we have and what we have in our lives. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you very much for your remarks, Mr. Baker. Yeah, I can't stress enough how much of a prevalent problem this is. I know a couple of years ago, I'm kind of getting the dates are a little hazy in my head, but literally a week or two following Ashley Johnson Bar Day, we actually lost someone in a very similar horrific fashion from Quinnahawk. And so it is still a prevalent problem. And as I think I've stated probably a million times now, I think it's incumbent upon all of us to do all that we can as representatives to ensure that our communities have the resources necessary to first stop these instances from happening, but also, find these folks when they go missing. So thank you very much for that, Representative Baker. Thank you, everyone who wore purple today. Today, we will be hearing an introduction on House Bill 347 by Representative Coulomb, House Bill 12 by Representative Josephson, and to close, we will have public testimony on Senate Joint Resolution 13 by Senator Dunbar, and as I've articulated to the committee before, it's my intent to move that bill today. So with that, we welcome Representative Coulomb and Aaliyah Preston, staff to Representative Coulomb. Will you please come forward, put yourself on the record? And I do believe we have a CS now that's fresh off the printer. And so if you could maybe give us an explanation of that, we can go ahead and try to get that adopted. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. My name is Representative Julie Coulomb. I represent District 11, South Anchorage Hillside. Introduce yourself.
Through the chair, my name is Aaliyah Preston, and I am a staffer for Representative Coulomb.
So the CS, there was a mistake made in the original bill. The real and true value definition was inadvertently taken out. The bill proposes a standard, does not replace that definition, and so with the CS, that definition is put back in. That's the only change to the CS.
Are there any questions for Representative Coulomb on the committee substitute? Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Coulomb. I understand the companion bill of this is being heard currently in the Senate. Is this now on par with what they're hearing?
Yes, it is. Through the chair to Representative Mears, yes.
Thank you.
It's the same.
Any further questions? Representative Himshut.
Thank you, through the chair, Rep. Coulomb. Have you reached out to the Alaska Association of Assessing Officers, because I think this is going to place quite a burden on them. Are they prepared to work through this?
Through the chair to Representative Hemshute, I have not reached out to them. Maybe if you could clarify the burden that you're concerned about, I could help with that.
Well, who's going to monitor?
Representative Hemshute, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I think we're discussing purely the CS. Yeah, that's quite all right. Vice Chair McCabe, did you have a question?
No, but I'm ready to move that CS if you want, so
yes.
We can discuss.
I apologize. I hate cutting anyone off, but I didn't want to get into it before we even had a presentation. So that's quite all right. Is there any further discussion on the committee substitute before we make the motion? I would entertain a motion to adopt the CS.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that the House Community and Regional Affairs Committee adopt committee substitute for House Bill 347, Work Order 33-LS1430/B, Bravo, as the working document.
Is there any objection? Hearing none, the committee substitute is now adopted. Thank you, Vice Chair McCabe. Representative Coulomb, now that we've established that, if you would like to proceed and begin your presentation.
Chair McCormick. So again, my name is Representative Julie Coulomb, and I represent House District 11. HB 347 will help communities by providing a path of fairness when it comes to property taxes by putting some baseline requirements in place for Alaska municipalities while preserving local control. The bill has the state set standards for Alaskans to know what the rules are for figuring property values, but giving municipalities the ability to adopt their own ordinances that might be unique to their jurisdiction. A possible amendment could be that these policies be made public by publishing them. It also changes the default for those who hear tax appeals to an appointed Board of Equalization instead of local elected officials. It's important to keep those separate when possible because Alaskans may feel they can't talk freely about their problems with their assessments or the assessment process with an elected official who will later sit as a quasi-judge over their appeal. HB 347 also stops a municipality from raising the assessed value during the appeal process. This benefits the citizen by stopping an immediate punitive appeal process. It levels the playing field for citizens with a recent appraisal in hand by requiring any Board of Equalization that doesn't agree with the fee appraisal to explain its findings on the record. It ensures assessors have the experience and credentials to do their job. And a lot of what's happening in this bill stems from some highly publicized issues with Haynes. The Haynes community had last year and Juneau. I got involved because years ago I was chair of the community council, and we were dealing with some assessment issues in Anchorage. And so when Senator Keel and I were talking about it, this is something that kind of evolved out of that conversation. We know that local control is important, but I think there's some standards that the state needs to solidify to make sure that the appeal process, the taxpayer has a fair shake in the appeal process. So I do look at this as a working document. I've been surprised at how many legislators have reached out to me on some of the issues they've had in their local jurisdiction. So I'm open to conversation, to amendments, and really want to make this bill stronger. So that's why we're here today. So with those remarks, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my staff, Aaliyah, for the sectional analysis.
Through the chair, my name is Aaliyah Preston, and I'll be reading the sectional analysis. Section 1 says that the local assessor used published standards may use state standards as default or adopt local standards by ordinance by regulation. Section 2 says states will, by regulation, adopt default standards based on existing best practices for assessing. Section 3 says the lead local assessor must be certified by the State Assessing Officers Association. Section 4 says changes the default to appointed Board of Equalization. Local government cannot get out by ordinance to sit on ASB Board of Equalization. Section 5 has two changes. The first change says that the government cannot raise the assessed value during the appeal unless the property owner requests it. Section 2, or the second change, says that the Board of Equalization must explain to an appellant their reasons if they disagree with a fee appraisal. Section 6 says that it lets the DCCED adopt regulations for the standards in Section 2. Section 7 has an immediate effective date to start regulation process. And then the last section, Section 8, says that January 1st is the effective date.
And we do have invited testimony in the department, but it's up to you, Chair. I didn't know if you wanted to do questions first or have them come speak.
Thank you, Representative Coulomb. Let's go ahead and have your invited testimony.
Okay.
Please state your name for the record and go ahead and begin your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Brenda Josephson, and I am a resident of Haynesboro. I want to thank you for allowing me to speak. I also want to thank Representative Coulomb for introducing this bill. I also would like to thank all the core sponsors of the bill. This bill has received bipartisan support because equal production, due process, and the right to fair and just treatment is not only in the Alaska Constitution, but it's ideals we all support and we all believe in. I'm very passionate about the need to codify assessment standards and best practices because I've personally witnessed unjust actions that have occurred in Haynesboro, as well as I've personally experienced it. Last year, the Haynesboro hired an uncertified contract assessor who enacted a new hybrid replacement cost new mass appraisal methodology. This methodology ignored actual market sales conditions by adding speculative costs for replacing existing structures. The stated goal was to equalize property values across large areas of the community. The replacement cost new approach, as enacted, did not properly consider the specific marketability of the parcels, nor did it give due weight to the physical and functional obsolescence of the buildings. This resulted in excessive assessments for some properties, especially buildings that were older and lower and middle valued properties that were not able to garner the high market values because the building qualities and locations were not desirable to the second home market. This approach resulted in what appeared in our community to be a regressive taxation scheme, shifting a disproportionate burden of the tax to the lower and middle valued properties, those owned and rented by the people in our community that could least afford the additional burden. Over 200 appeals were filed with the assessor's office. Many more property owners did not file appeals out of a belief that you can't fight City Hall. The assessor refused to address the merits of many of the appeals, and property owners were faced with a confrontational process. Appellants have spoken out about how they were subjected to unprofessional interactions, an unwillingness to correct obvious errors, retaliatory increases, willful misdescriptions of their properties, and a lack of sufficient notice for hearing dates, and failure to receive assessor's staff reports as required by the borough's published policy. I regret that I don't have more time to go into the details, but just to give you some brief examples of what happened, there was a case in the Canfields appeal where the property owner supported an appeal of an assessment of $865,000 with a fee appraisal that was at $620,000. A local realtor supported the fee appraisal, and actually the local realtor, 26 years experience, said that she felt the fee appraisal was higher than what she would put it on the market. because the area just could not justify that. The Board of Equalization heard the appeal and remanded it back to the assessor for consideration. The assessor came back after going out to the building and looked at all the properties, even assessed everything with replacement cost new, and came back with a $1.1 million assessment, which was not supported by full and true market value. There was a Carter appeal where the young lady was representing her mother's estate, who had passed, single mother, who came to Haines, home built her house by putting together whatever scrap material she could. She received an excessive assessment beyond full and true market value, appealed it, and actually when the assessor came in, increased it, and with a very positive bias. Everything that she showed about how it wasn't up to building codes, wasn't up to standards, was ignored. And it was particularly disturbing because she couldn't get it worked out. She went to the Board of Equalization, and she was left having to disparage the building that her mother built from her late mother in public. And it should have been addressed in the privacy with respect. The Smiths, Mark and Lori Smith, had four appeals that they filed. All four of their appeals received, the assessor threatened that they would increase the assessments on all four of these appeals if they did not drop them. They did not drop them. They went forward to the Board of Equalization, and 90 minutes before their appeal packet was due to the assessor, they received notification that all four of their properties were increased with assessment. Two of the buildings increased significantly, over 30%. And even a vacant lot went up $10,000. And this was all without a site visit or further information to justify these increases. It was retaliation, and it was living out the threat that they would increase it if they didn't drop it. The most heartbreaking appeal was the Hoy appeal. A woman had lived in a building that was originally a mobile home that had a front porch added onto it with a roof over it. When the mobile home became dilapidated, they removed the mobile home and put up some walls, never completely finished it, lived in a quarter of it. The assessment came in with a replacement cost new, as if this was built to code, just said that he discounted it as 49%, not complete. The assessment was way beyond anything full and true market value would have been. And the Board of Equalization ended up upholding the assessors. It was so heartbreaking because this was one of the people in our community that could least afford to receive this disproportionate burden of the tax. And the community actually fundraised, and we paid the additional taxes for her. I personally had an appeal. I had no intentions a year ago of appealing anything. I received a corrected notice in the mail before I received the assessment with a building value for a non-existent single-family home on a vacant lot I owned. I thought it was going to be an easy appeal. I filled out the appeal form, a couple sentences saying this is an obvious error, it's a vacant lot. First, I received an unwillingness to address it or even acknowledge that I did not have a building on this lot. When they finally did remove the building, I received a 45% increase on the land value, above and beyond any other property in the two-block area, which was easy for me to prove because in my neighborhood, the lots are similar topo, similar views, 1 to 2 acres. It was very easy to see the mathematical calculation and no justification for the 45% increase. As these issues were coming to light, it took months. I was an appellant for 6 months. I filed my appeal in April. It was finally resolved at the Board of Equalization. October 16th or 18th, I believe it was, 6 months, our Board of Equalization served, our assembly served as a Board of Equalization. a lot of injustices occurred along the way. Our assembly members did not know about what was happening because we could not talk to them. The day I filed my appeal, people I would normally have contact with, at least on a weekly basis, I could not because of ex parte communications. They learned slowly, 15 minutes at a time, what was happening. After one of the appeals, the Canfield case, when the appeal was remanded back to the assessor, the borough manager chastised the assembly member serving as Board of Equalization, telling her it was her job to support the assessor and telling her that they were wrong for not upholding the assessment. Completely not appropriate for fair and just trials. Our assembly, it was not their fault what happened. They were victims of a process that had them sitting in the Board of Equalization. Once everything came to light, they are taking steps now in order to have an appointed board. The unjust results was heartbreaking to see, and it was the result of a statute that does not protect our rights to fair and just treatment. The House Bill 347 establishes some guardrails that are needed to help reestablish some trust in the assessment process. It helps to promote a transparent and professional approach by requiring the assessor to be certified. The assessor that enacted all of these, he was uncertified. He actually came from Juneau, and he had left Juneau after doing similar. He knew the weaknesses in the law. He took advantages of the weaknesses in the law. And it protects our ability to redress our government by defaulting it to an appointed Board of Equalization. Our assembly would not have allowed to happen if they would have known, but they couldn't know because we couldn't approach them. And this bill helps to prevent the chilling effect of the retaliatory increases in the assessment. Out of the over 200 appeals, most of them dropped when they were threatened with the increases, especially when one of the first appeals was the Canfield appeal, where they came in with the fee appraisal and they were just shut down with it. So they're, rather than face an increase, they dropped their appeals. So I'm advocating that you pass this out of committee and that you help to reestablish some protections for the people so that there can be trust in the assessment process.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Mrs. Josephson. I'll now open the committee for questions. Vice Chair McCabe.
Thank you, Ms. Josephson. So happens I have a very close friend and former coworker that lives in Haines now. I moved back there from the Valley after retiring from the same airline I work for. And so I'm aware of this. He actually stopped me 18 months ago, and we had almost a two-hour-long conversation, I think, in Home Depot, standing around in the aisles talking about this. So he's very frustrated. I get your frustration, but I do have a few questions. The assessor works for the mayor, correct?
Through the chair, the assessor was hired by the administration. My understanding is he was a direct report to the borough manager.
Okay, follow-up.
Follow-up, Vice Chair McCabe.
And this is like the third hearing we've had on some sort of assessment deal. There was one in Fairbanks. Seems to me we had one last year, right, on some sort of weaponizing, if you will, of the assessor's office or of the taxation for the borough. I myself have been subject to that piece of it. So, where does it stand now? Is he still there? Has the assembly let him go? Has the borough manager let him or her? I don't know if it's a man or a woman, but
yeah, through the chair. There was a pretty loud, the community was very upset with what had happened. They had seen the injustice. There was a community petition that one of the appellants, it was actually the father of the Canfield, had circulated asking for the removal of the contract assessor on the basis that he was uncertified. He was a gentleman who came to town. He was not certified in the state of Alaska as an assessor. He was not licensed as an appraiser. And the petition asked for his removal on the basis that he was uncertified. It acknowledged in the petition that although the state of Alaska doesn't require any professional credentials, most municipalities do. And on the basis of let's hold ourselves to a higher level than hiring people in on a contract basis that are uncertified. Nearly 600 people signed that petition. It was circulated for 9 days. Pretty amazing as someone it's a small community. We know each other. We're politically divided on many issues. It's pretty fun watching and seeing the names on the same pieces of paper, thinking, when did these two people ever agree? Yeah. So in response, and I will tell you, lots of times we have people elected to office that don't get that many votes. So it was pretty powerful. The assembly responded. It was newly elected assembly. They responded immediately. It was easy. His contract was up in December. It was up for automatic renewal. They made the choice not to renew his contract.
Cool.
Follow up, Vice Chair McCabe.
I think it demonstrates exactly what our Constitution says, right? Government of the people, by the people, for the people. And, if you don't like the way you're being governed, and unfortunately this really isn't governance, but it kind of is, you have to have a means to remove that person. So what happened to all the money that was collected? Did you have a party? Or I guess I shouldn't say that. I'll probably be in some newspaper somewhere. But was it helpful to Haynes to have sort of that extra money for from the over-assessments, if you will?
Through the chair, I'm an ex-assembly member. I've never seen a government that didn't have ways to spend the people's money, regardless of how they got it. So, yes, it was spent.
Thanks.
Representative Hemshute, and I promise this time I will not cut you off.
I promise this time I'll pay attention. So, thank you, through the chair. Ms. Josephson, I don't know if you'll be able to answer this. It might be too technical a question, but my question is, in the bill, it says that the Board of Equalization might be the assembly, or it may be made up of citizens along with the assembly, or it could be a combination, or it could be just the citizens. But wouldn't even the citizens who are appointed or selected to the board be required not to talk about the cases in the same way that your assembly members were? Standard of not discussing the cases that prevented your assembly from knowing what was going on would still be in place regardless of who is on the board.
Through the chair, that is correct. In any quasi-judicial hearing, once you are an appellant, you've got a hearing before a board, you cannot have ex parte communications with them. Our problem was not that we could not speak about the specifics of our appeal to our assembly. Our problem was that we could not go to our assembly and say, hey, we've got a big problem that's happening with our borough administration and with this process. And we are not getting, to be very specific, I'll give you one example. We had a long established policy, Board of Equalization policy, that the staff report, the assessor's staff report, would be made available to the appellants 5 working days prior to the hearing. That was not happening. People were not getting the staff report timely. And when a point of order was made to that, our borough administration unilaterally changed the policy so that the staff report had to be made available prior to the hearing. Could have been 5 minutes. It could have been just before the hearing started. those policies per our borough code are owned by the Board of Equalization. They're not owned, the policies are not owned by the borough administration. It was completely inappropriate for the borough administration to unilaterally change it, and it was a violation of the appellant's due process. They didn't even know what they were fighting about or what they were going to be arguing about prior to going into their Board of Equalization hearing. So if we could have let our assembly know that we were having challenges with our borough administration, they would not have allowed it to happen what happened. It wasn't the specifics of the cases that we wanted to tell our assembly about. We wanted to tell them about the due process and the issues and the lack of fair hearings that were happening. They did take us seriously once they found out.
Follow up, Representative Himshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, just to be completely clear then, if the Board of Equalization were made up at least partially of regular citizens or fully of regular citizens, the assembly would then be clear for you to speak with them about the difficulties that you were experiencing, and you wouldn't be violating that, I guess, confidentiality with the Board of Equalization because it would be a separate set of people.
Yeah, through the chair, that is correct. Our problem was the due process and the violations that were happening in general. It was a heavy-handed approach. And actually, our Board of Equalization started figuring out that something wasn't right. They requested a retraining, a Board of Equalization retraining from the state assessor. In that retraining, the state assessor, who is now the former state assessor, basically said, you know, you need to support your assessor. And even if the assessments they're doing, regularly result in assessments above and beyond full and true market value, it doesn't matter if it's 100%, doesn't matter if it's 200%, you should go with what the assessor comes up with because it's uniformity that matters. So if everyone's uniformly 150%, that's okay. The problem with that is the one standard we have, the one thing in statute, is that properties are to be assessed at full and true market value, what a willing seller would give a willing buyer in a transaction at, where both were conversant with the property.
Are there any additional questions? Ms. Josephson, thank you for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Well, please state your name for the record. You can go right ahead with your testimony.
I will, Mr. Chairman. I am Joe Geldhoff. I am a resident of West Juneau. And I've been an attorney in Alaska for a lot of years. I believe I was asked to come and testify to you to talk a little bit about the background because I have done some appeals and I've worked with Brenda and other people to address the issue that is contemplated by this bill. Brenda's laid out some of the, frankly, horror stories that have taken place here. But I want to, so what can I do to help you in your deliberations? I can probably give you some context. First, this is not a Haines-specific problem or a Juneau problem. This is an actual problem in a number of places in Alaska. And if it's not an actual problem, it's certainly a potential problem. Addressing this, the legislature addressing this, you're well advised to do this and stop some of the problems that have actually taken place or will take place if you don't address this. It's tempting to say that this is a rogue assessor. It certainly was true in Haines. It certainly was true in Juneau. In places like Sitka, which have a remarkably practical and sensible assessor, this isn't much of a problem. And if it is, it gets worked out before you go through this cumbersome process before a Board of Equalization. But what's really driving this, and this is, I think, the context here, Alaska's become a place where we're forever wringing our hands about not enough money. Consciously or unconsciously, some of the local governments, either through their administration or the assembly, have decided we need more money. And it's going to come from property taxes, at least in part. So I would offer you a couple points to think about. Justice Marshall, the original Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court in the McCulloch versus Maryland case, famously wrote, and he was really cribbing off from Daniel Webster, I think, but the power to tax is the power to destroy. That is one pole to hold in mind as you deliberate on this. But I'd also invoke another justice of the United States Supreme Court, Oliver Wendell Holmes, who talked about, you know, the price of maintaining a civilized society here is taxation. Now, somewhere in between those two points, which were articulated, we have to come up with a way of taxing that is not excessive, and that is, to use an overworked term, fair. This bill, and thank you to the representative for bringing this forward, it is not a partisan measure. It's just really grounded, I think, in fundamental fairness, and it addresses and eliminates some really potential for abuse that has been discussed here. I have a few concerns, but certainly not fatal, about outsourcing standards to another body. The way this bill is written, it's certainly adequate. It's even beyond adequate. But I always, and I raise to you for your consideration, whenever we allow the executive branch to start adopting standards, there's a potential for mischief. It's only a point there. It's not necessarily dispositive of whether this bill should be enacted, because it's a significant improvement. But I urge you to think about, when we ask the executive branch to start adopting standards, and they in turn are adopting standards from a trade group, there's always a potential there that you get regulatory capture. But as written, this is a very good beginning. The issue of allowing the local governments to opt out is good, because not all municipalities need the full belt and braces that probably will adopt in places like Juneau or Anchorage. But I certainly hope somebody addresses, in terms of the intent, that the standards to be adopted in this measure are a floor, and that you can't just basically have a local government adopting some Wild West standard with no standard at all. And I'll conclude my testimony, and I'm not trying to be pedantic here, but this truly is not rocket science assessing property. The tried and true, the three tried and true means of adopting or assessing property really flow from, one, a comparative sales market, which is not always easy. But, you know, you look at four or five comps that are of similar nature, and you rationalize the differences between those, and you come up with a full and true market value. That's really the gold standard for assessing property, particularly property in which we live, residential property. The third, the second, is based on income. So if you've got a commercial property and you can see the revenue stream, you come up with that. The third, and this is where a lot of problems came in Haynes and Juneau, is using cost. And that's really a replacement cost. Replacement cost is good if you're writing insurance policies and in some situations. But the situation where this rogue assessor started using replacement costs in places like Juneau and Haynes was truly out of control. And then it led to this reappraisal at a higher value, which was really a form of blackmail. So I think I've done all I can to provide you a little context, but I applaud your hearing this. At some point, move it along. I would only ask that make sure that you discuss, and that the record reflects, that the intent, if you allow local governments, which is appropriate, to adopt their own standards, that they be the standards embedded in state law, and that's a floor. So you can't just have a standard-free area. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you for your testimony this morning, Mr. Geldof. Are there any questions? All right. Well, thank you very much. Representative Coulomb. Oh, excuse me. You have one more invited testifier. I apologize. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Hanna. I'm a Juneau taxpayer. My family's been here since 1880. I'd like to thank the representative for bringing this legislation forward. I'll try and be very brief. There's no reason not to pass this legislation. It actually assigns no cost to the state, and all it does is it forces the municipalities to do that which they claim they already do. They already claim to follow all these rules and these standards, but we know for a fact they don't. Now, most assessors do follow the rules. I've worked with maybe 20 assessors over the years. One bad one, 5%. Not a bad ratio, but it had some horrific results. You'll hear many egregious horror stories about these problems that have occurred. I assure you, though, they're only the tip of the iceberg. A couple years ago, I attended somewhere between 70 or 80 Board of Equalization hearings. I could go on for quite some time testifying to these horror stories. It was just incredible what went on at those hearings. And one of the problems is right now the taxpayer has no redress. The statute right now gives full deference to the assessor's office. The Board of Equalization is basically told to accept their work at face value. And unless somebody can basically prove some sort of fraudulent intent, which we attempted to do and they didn't let us do that, they have to accept the assessor's findings. And the assessor is not required to show his work. He's not required to justify how he comes up with these assessments. And we have to remember that these assessors are not required to have any education. They're not required to have any certifications. They're not required to demonstrate any experience. They're just given the authority to go out and assess valuation to your property, and they may or may not be up to that task. So you come into a hearing, you have a Board of Equalization that's been instructed by the assessor, often by the state assessor too. After looking at their orientation, I realized that the assessor's office was giving them false instructions. They were actually telling them information that was patently goes against the rules of standard appraisal work. It was horrendous to see what was going on. So you have a Board of Equalization that's been indoctrinated by someone who's not following the rules, and it was so bad. At one point, we had a Board of Equalization chair that would refer to the municipality as we. They were not recognizing that they were supposed to be an impartial third-party quasi-judicial board. They considered themselves part of the assessor's office. The bias was incredible. So with all this in mind, a taxpayer will decide to go to court. Well, unfortunately, if you go to Superior Court, the court is only allowed to review what the Board of Equalization allows into the record. Well, we've had multiple issues of information given to the board that was not allowed into the record. You only have a 15-minute hearing. It's incredibly hard to present your whole case in 15 minutes. And yet this is all the Superior Court is allowed to review. So the deck, it's totally stacked against the taxpayer. And there's two sides of this. Like I said, there's two problems. One is the assessor is not bound to play by any rules. He can use any system he wants. For example, this assessor that's been mentioned wrote his own CAMA program, which stands for Computer Assisted Mass Appraisal. He wrote his own black box program. And through some research of my own, I found out that he'd used this in multiple municipalities. And with his program, he could do what was called trimming the data, so he could just eliminate the sales data that he didn't like. And it would shift the model. Some municipalities are using outdated systems. Our people actually admitted they didn't know how our model worked. They just had to trust it. It was staggering to hear this. The bullying you've heard about, it's not only true, it's in writing. It was often the case that you would receive your letter, I have copies of mine, where it tells you right there that we may have only assessed your property at 90% of true market value. So if you want to go ahead with your appeal, we may elect to go ahead and assess it at what we feel is 100% of true market value. And they have the ability to adjust that number up even beyond what their first computations arose at. So like Ms. Josephson said, we had numerous people that when they saw the first couple of appeals denied, they backed out of their appeals. It was costing them tens and tens of thousands of dollars in excess fees. This Board of Equalization, if you go to the International Association of Assessing Officers, it tells you that it should be made up of industry professionals, you know, assessors, appraisers, real estate brokers, mortgage lenders, insurance folks. We had none of those on our board. They actually did not even understand how a cap rate affects the value of your property. They didn't understand that an assessor using a 5% cap rate, which might be appropriate in booming downtown Seattle, was not appropriate anywhere in Alaska, let alone municipalities that had just been affected by COVID and had a 50% vacancy rate in their downtown commercial properties. They did not understand this. It was ignorance on their part. And we weren't allowed to educate them on it. We really need to think about how we can incentivize folks to apply for the boards, because it is hard for a municipality to find people to staff those boards. It's very hard. So that provision where they can allow the assembly to be the BOE, that may be necessary in a very tiny community. They may just not have enough engaged citizenry to staff a board like that. But we should strive to have these boards be staffed by people or manned by people that understand the problem at hand and can be impartial and not just be an arm of the city. I could go on for a long time. There's mountains of rules about what these municipalities should be following. As you can see, I've done some reading. They've broken many, many, many of them. Could go on for quite some time about the rules they've broken, but the point being is, let's just make them follow the rules. They claim they do. Let's have them do it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony this morning, Mr. Hanna. Are there any questions? Vice Chair McCabe.
Thanks.
Here.
So you're from Juneau. I think the last thing that we heard last year was where they wanted the Juneau Assembly or somebody in Juneau, maybe it was the assessor, wanted a full report on what the property sold for, if I'm not mistaken, to be placed instead of, you know, we in the Matsu, it's just $10 and other consideration or something like that. So how much you paid for a property is sort of hidden from the assessor. And now in Juneau, I think the last time we heard something like this, it was they wanted the value of the property on the public record, and it came out that it was so that the assessor could tax you on what you paid for it, not on the value of the property. Does that ring a bell? Am I right on that?
Through the chair, thank you. Yes, that's true. We actually, for a year, had disclosure requirement in Juneau. And you know, it's interesting. This is a double-edged sword. Many places down south have disclosure rules. In fact, some of the folks that were out-of-state property owners here in Juneau were aghast to find out that we did not have full disclosure, so they couldn't go find sales data so they could come up with their own comps for like properties to appeal to the assessor. It actually, in many times, would be helpful if we were a full disclosure municipality. But thanks to the effort of the realtors group, they brought forth an initiative, and the full disclosure was voted down, and we no longer have that. Truthfully, though, the sales data is already out there. All an assessor would have to do is go to Zillow, and they could find out what homes are selling for. This is not rocket science. And the fact is right now, the way it stands now, when you go into these hearings, the assessor is given deference, even if you come in with a fee appraisal or two of them or three of them that show what market conditions are and what comparable sales are, if the assessor has some sort of black box system where he can refute that without showing his work, the BOE gives that deference.
Thanks.
Is there any additional questions for Mr. Hanna? Hearing none, thank you again for your testimony and answering our question this morning. Representative Coulomb, if you'd like to return to the table, I think we can open up for questions. I do just want to note we're going to have to change around the schedule here a little bit. Senator Dunbar let me know that he has an engagement to get to, so we're going to take up SJR 13 following this. But just wanted to open the floor if there's any questions for Representative Coulomb. Representative Himshute.
Thank you. Through the chair, now my question. On page 2 of the bill, there's assessor certification, which in testimony it's clear that folks are looking for some kind of guarantee that the people performing the work of assessment have been trained to do that. My concern is the Alaska Association of Assessing Officers. Does this place a burden on them, or who keeps track of this? Through the chair. Thank you.
Through the chair to Representative Himshute. So, I guess when you're referring to burden, so you're anticipating an increase of them having to get these level 3 certifications. I would have to look and see exactly how many municipalities don't have that. I don't anticipate there's a huge load that's going to be coming that they have to certify. It also, this has a provision, too. It works under the supervision of an individual with a level 3 certification. So you could have a less certification. You just have to have a someone supervising you. So I don't anticipate a huge burden there.
Follow-up, Representative Himshute. Vice Chair McCabe, did you have a question?
So I'm interested to know, I think there is a state statute that says when it's supposed to be, or maybe that's in borough code, how often you're supposed to assess a house. So I built my own house out of pocket. It took me 10 years. And when I went to the borough and asked them, how do you assess this? They said, well, because of the size of the borough and the smallness of the assessor's office, which kind of goes to what Representative Himshute was saying, how much is this going to cost? They do it all by square footage of your roof via airplane or satellite, and they'll check it. But even still, it's a big task for them to do that every 5 years or every 10 years or whenever it's supposed to be. So is there, and I was kind of looking for it, I don't see a statute that says when it's required to be assessed or reassessed. I thought it was every 5 years, but yeah. I could be wrong.
So through the chair to represent McCabe, it is every 5 years, although it does defer to local municipalities. They can do it. Some of them are doing it every 3 years. Some do more than 5 years, but is my understanding that it's every 5 years.
Follow-up, Vice Chair McCabe.
Yeah, thanks. So what happens when the borough doesn't follow that or the state doesn't follow that? Are they liable, or is there any relief? How does that work? I mean, in my case, it was weaponized, and some guy filled out a form with the borough, and they sent two tax assessors out to my property to personally assess my property. Nobody else around me had been assessed in 10 years, I think, or 8 years, over 8 years. And yet I had a special assessment because this guy loves me so much. So I just wonder if there's a way to prevent that or a way to force the borough to do it when they're supposed to so that we don't open ourselves up to liability. Or if there's a way to self-report, say, hey, I think I need more taxes on my house.
Well, through the chair to Representative McCabe, I am not aware of anything that at the state level that says that there's some kind of penalty. I have looked at a lot of it really varies from borough to municipality. A lot of this is controlled locally, and so I can't speak to how the borough affects that. It is in their best interest to assess properties on a regular basis because it tends to result in underassessments if they don't do that, if they don't update it. So I would suspect that most local governments try to stay on that schedule as much as possible.
Thanks.
I should note, we do have a director of the Division of Community and Regional Affairs on the line, Sandra Moore. Ms. Moore, if you have anything to chime in on this, please go right ahead.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the committee, thank you. This is Sandra Moeller, the director of the Division of Community Regional Affairs. And the Representative Coulombe is correct that most of this is defined at the local level. We encourage municipalities to look at, they're required to provide us their assessed value every year. So it's up to the individual municipality to provide, to decide when they would actually do their assessments. So we do require them to provide their values for us to determine the full value determination for the state and the state school funding. So I wanted to add that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moeller. Are there any further questions, Representative Ruffridge?
Thank you, Chair McCormick. I just have a couple of questions. Potentially, would it be possible to get a either through your office or potentially the Alaska Association of Assessing Officers, what is required to be a level 3 certified assessor? And then sort of the second question attached to that is, it seems like there's two different types of people in this real estate market. There's an assessor that sort of comes in at the end after property is owned and gives a value attached to it. But then there's also an appraisal that can occur when a property is sold and has to do with like a bank or a loan or something like that. And these two individuals seem to be relatively different and they really sometimes give a different value to things. Is it possible to speak about either the difference between an assessor and an appraiser? Why is there not a... Seems like in some cases those two things would be better off to be linked somehow, but I don't know if that's something you feel comfortable speaking to or something we can talk about at a later hearing. Thank you.
So through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, I can speak very surface about that. Maybe the department would want to chime in, but to your first point, yes, we can get the requirements to level 3 officer. I do know that it's, I think it's a 6 years. You have to have 6 years of experience and a lot of, you have to pass tests and a lot of education, but I can get more specifics for you. Assessor versus appraiser, actually was interesting in my district because that there's a whole issue on whether the, a fee appraisal counts as argument against what was assessed. And so, again, a lot, it varies during or with local governments. So in Anchorage, in my district, you can bring a fee appraisal to the challenge and say, hey, you know, we got this. This is what is appraised. This is what the assessor's saying. They do take into account, they are required to write out on the record why they refuse that or why they don't think it's appropriate or why they accept it. So that is not the case in a lot of places in Alaska, though. They can just reject it and just say, well, we don't think that applies. There is some questions around the motivation from an assessor or an appraisal, you know, that it's kind of in the camp of the homeowner, and so it's looked on as skeptical, but I think there is definitely some conflict between those two, because I think the homeowners are like, this is a good appraisal. I don't understand why this isn't being accepted. But there are some different standards that an assessor uses as opposed to an appraisal.
Thank you.
Follow up, Representative Ruffridge. Are there any further questions for Representative Coulombe? Well, Representative Coulombe, I want to thank you for your presentation this morning. I guess I would like to afford you the opportunity before Moving on, just to give some closing remarks if you have any.
Thank you, Chair McCormick. I just want to say thank you to the committee for hearing the bill. I think there has been really apparent that there's an issue here with assessments throughout the state, not in just one locality. So hope you take it under consideration. This actually helps a lot of the cracks in the system and retains local control. So appreciative of you guys listening.
Thank you, Representative Coulomb. For the committee and public's awareness, we will have public testimony on this bill on Thursday. I guess I will just put it out there for folks. If you have any amendments that you're considering, please start working on them now. But we will set HB 347 aside. Thank you, Representative Coulomb. We'd now welcome back with a slight schedule change, Senator Dunbar. Senator Dunbar, is it just, excuse me, if you could just kind of provide a brief recap of SJR 7, we can open up public testimony. I don't believe we have any testifiers, but did I say the wrong one? SJR 13.
SJR 13.
Okay.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the committee for hearing this. This is, for the record, Forrest Dunbar, Senator for District J. SJR 13 supports the Alaska Native Village Municipal Lands Restoration Act of 2023, which is sponsored by all three members of our federal delegation. It seeks to fix an issue with ANCSA Provision 14C3 that set aside land held in state trust for future municipalities that we no longer believe will actually come into being. And so this restores the lands to Alaska Native Village corporations for their use. And we believe because these are good and central lands in these communities that some of it will be used for housing, which is another ancillary benefit. So this is our chance as a legislature to weigh in support of this bill being carried by our federal delegation.
Thank you, Senator Dunbar. I think we'll go ahead now and open public testimony. Is there anyone hiding in the room that is here for public testimony that is not signed up? Always got to check. I don't believe there is. And do we have anyone online? Okay. So I will now close public testimony on SJR 13. Are there any questions for Senator Dunbar? I also would like to note we also have Senator Mueller on the line who can take questions as well. Are there any questions for SJR 13? None. Okay. Well, you're an efficient bunch. I would entertain a motion then to move SJR 13.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move SJR 13 Work Order 33-LS1205/Bravo with amendments and attached fiscal notes.
Are there any objections? Hearing none. SJR 13 passes without objection. We'll now take a brief at ease to sign the report.
Mr. Chair, I apologize for that. I believe I need to abstain as I work for an ANCSA Village Corporation. Oh boy.
I'll object to that. Brief at ease. I'll take a brief at ease while we sign the report. Brief at ease. All right, we are now back on the record. Now we welcome Representative Josephson and staff, Alexander Schroeder. Would you please put yourself on the record? Go ahead and begin your presentation on HB 12.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, committee. I'm Andy Josephson, House District 13 at South Midtown in Anchorage.
For the record, my name is Alexander Schroeder, staff to Representative Josephson.
Mr. Chairman, we appreciate you calendaring this bill. The bill is a bill that would allow expressly municipalities to regulate trapping. This is a bill that I first carried in 2017. This very committee moved it out of committee. Of course, it's got different members on it now. I refiled the bill between then and now, and this is its first hearing, I think, since that 2017-18 term. The bill does the following thing. It's as you can see, a short bill. It would allow for municipalities to have their space in the interest of public safety and general welfare, terms associated with their police powers, to regulate trapping as they saw fit within their borders. Now, the first thing is that, and you may be all maybe more expertise on this than I am, but where a municipality is a home rule, we assert that it has those powers now. And so many cities and municipalities like Anchorage and Juneau, we submit, have that authority now. And I'll tell you why I say we submit. Boroughs, typically second-class boroughs, have more restricted powers relating to their ability and power to regulate land use. So they don't get the benefit of this sort of broader police power for general welfare, health is another term used, and public safety. The reason I say we submit is that the matter presented by this bill is coming to a head, I'm tempted to say, at a theater near you. And in this case, I mean at a courthouse near you, the Supreme Court. So what happened was the state, actually, let me retract that. The Alaska Trappers Association and the National Trappers Association sued the city of Valdez over its regulation of trapping within its boundaries. I think the state has joined in that. I need to confirm that. I'm pretty sure they have. My invited testifiers will know. This in a sense, is no surprise because this issue has been sort of boiling and growing over the last, I'd say, decade. For example, in 2017, when I first engaged in this issue, the Mat-Su Borough was actively involved in wanting to carve out spaces where trapping would be disallowed, again, in the interest of public safety and health. Its attorney at the time, Nicholas Spiropoulos, wrote a very readable and I think well-considered legal memorandum that I reviewed again this morning and concluded that the regulation the Mat-Su Borough was trying to carve out may have gone a step or two too far, and I'm not sure I can tell you exactly how. I'd have to review that further. But nonetheless, the Mat-Su Borough is one of, I believe, 15 areas in the state that has prohibited trapping in some circumstances. Now, these are often very limited. They may be 50-foot buffers off of select trails. They may be setbacks from school playgrounds. So they're not necessarily, I believe, that much of an impediment on the state's regulatory authority. Regarding the state's regulatory authority, the first thing is the state has never said it could, and it would emanate from this building. The state has never said local governments can't do this. That's never been a policy of the state. And in fact, look from the other side of the coin, the Board of Game doesn't look at things typically in the interest of public safety and health. It's not a lens they look through. So one of the things you see in the briefs before the Supreme Court is the city of Valdez attorneys joined in, by the way, certainly in moral support, if not real support, by the Alaska Municipal League, which must, I would submit, be supportive of this bill, I believe, because I've just read their resolution, and it looks like it's every argument I'm making before you. But looked at from the other side, as I was saying, there is some belief that local governments are required to regulate and have a sort of affirmative duty to look out for public health and safety. So, again, the state has never co-opted that expressly, And interestingly, in the law that creates the authority for the Board of Game to regulate game, which we all know exists, it refers to that authority as being a may authority. And that's, we think, important in these legal briefs as well, because it suggests the Board of Game could say, we're just not going to get involved that much in trapping one way or the other. It is a discretionary activity on their part. And that is found in AS 1605-255. So we think the board's authority is non-exclusive and discretionary. And you may say, well, why don't we see how the Supreme Court rules on this? That's certainly an option, but you invited me to your committee and I'm here. And we think that there's always some benefit in codifying something like this, if for no other reason for the public, for public access and public information. And we also think, and I don't suggest that there be any way to intervene in the lawsuit or put a thumb on the scale, but certainly if the state had a position allowing regulation of trapping, that would be an important factor probably for the court at some future date. So those are the main things. I can tell you more about the nuances in the litigation. I think that you'll be surprised at the number of communities that already regulate trapping. And they do this because, they do it in part because they're entitled to protect property interests. And the law and the courts have said that pets are a property interest. In fact, one Supreme Court talks about the emotional importance of, for example, a dog to a dog owner. That is actually in court cases, published decisions. And then there's, of course, the safety factor for children and for other recreationalists. So that's what brings us here. And I don't want to take too much more time. We have a PowerPoint and we have two invited testifiers. If I can answer any questions, I'll try.
Thank you, Representative Josephson. I think we'll just go ahead and proceed with the presentation, and then kind of on the back end, we'll open up for questions.
Sure.
Again, for the record, my name is Alexander Schroeder, staff to Representative Josephson. Just want to thank the committee for hearing this bill. So moving along with the presentation, the Alaska Constitution has two different sections that are in conversation related to trapping in this instance.
Okay. Okay. Please continue.
Okay. Promise that wasn't part of slide two.
Disappointing.
The first is Article 10, Section 11, which deals with local governments. It's meant to provide scope. Section 1 is meant to provide scope for the entire article and requires the state to provide for maximum local self-government. Unless the law prohibits a city's legislative power, they are entitled to legislate themselves. So that's the first That's the first article of the Constitution that deals with this particular issue. The second is Article 8, which deals with the state's responsibility over natural resources. The crux of this article is to provide resources in accordance with, quote, maximum use consistent with the public interest, end quote, under Article 8, Section 1. Under Article 8, Section 3, these resources are supposed to be provided for the, quote, common use, end quote. Now, one might think this could create some conflicts in the historical record between conservation and access, but a Supreme Court case called Brooks v. Wright has commented on this issue, if I may read just a brief sentence from this. It says, quote, "We find little support in the public trust line of cases for the proposition that the common use clause of Article 8 grants the legislator exclusive power to make laws dealing with natural resource management." Which is why, moving on to the next slide, that we've had 15 cities or municipalities already pass regulations related to trapping, or laws or regulations related to trapping. This chart lists what we currently know are the municipal codes restricting trapping in some way or another, in whole or in part, in the areas of these boundaries. The oldest restriction spans all the way back to 1960 in Fairbanks, and the most recent being 2023 in Seward. So if they restrict trapping, why do we need this bill? Well, trapping regulations provided by Alaskans by the Department of Fish and Game are extremely permissive and vague. The trapping regulations provided by the department recommend certain actions, such as to avoid placing traps close to areas where members of the community may use. However, there's no penalty in law for doing so, and in fact, they recommend trappers to be responsible so that they can continue to trap, but doesn't mention anything related to the dangers of trapping near these areas or the harm that they cause to pets. On the flip side, Alaska Statute 1605-790 does lay down penalties for civilians who disable the traps. So you could spend a month in prison for disabling the trap, even if it was to do so to protect other civilians, children, or animals. And in fact, in their regulations, they mention that you are required to report the disabling of a trap, but there is no requirement to report an animal caught in a trap. So why do I bring up animals? Well, some of the regulations you saw on the previous slide, where I show different cities and municipalities that already regulate trapping, they house it in parts of their code related to animals, and typically it's brought on by instances of cruelty to animals or instances where animals are caught in traps. So the Matsu Borough and the municipality of Anchorage have both passed codes after receiving multiple instances of dogs or pets caught in traps. And these aren't just dogs that are pets that you're walking along a trail with. There's instances of sled dogs being caught in traps, search and rescue dogs being caught in traps, hunting dogs being caught in traps. So this isn't just some issue of people need to put their dogs on leashes. This affects all sorts of people and their pets. But as part of the bill packet, you know, we've attached a how-to guide on how to remove your animal from these traps because it's so common. And the Department of Fish and Game, it provides a brochure on that information. The brochure, it should be noted that the brochure says, quote, keeping your pet safe is your responsibility. It's not the trapper's responsibility. And they don't keep track of how many pets are caught in traps, which is why we've included the map to trap in the bill packet. But they do, like I said, they do require and report the disabling of traps. So with that being said, what does the bill do? Well, the bill explicitly says that municipalities have the authority to regulate trapping in their own boundaries. As we've seen, this is already a desire all over the state. It is to do so explicitly to protect persons and property, which includes pets, who deserve to be protected through local ordinances passed by the people in that area and not a state board. But it does nothing to limit the Department of Environmental Conservation, the Department of Fish and Game, or the Department of Public Safety. And that is our presentation.
Thank you very much for that presentation, Mr. Schroeder. We'll move now to invited testimony. Representative Josephson, did you have preference on who?
First? I do. I think based on their schedules, Lorraine Temple.
Okay.
Would be first.
Sure. Ms. Temple, please go ahead and state your name for the record. Begin your testimony.
Yes. Okay, my name is Lorraine Temple. Good morning. I am a 40-year resident of the Kenai Peninsula with homes in Cooper Landing and Homer. I'm a third-year member of our local advisory committee to the Board of Game, and I'm a founder and leader of the Cooper Landing Safe Trails Committee, as well as a member of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. I spent a number of years commercial fishing, but primarily I ran businesses as a dog musher, guiding guests into the backcountry. My activities in Homer were less confrontational than what I've come to experience in Cooper Landing. However, recently Homer's had its dog entrapment occurrences on ski trails, so it's escalated there as well. Cooper Landing is unique in that recreational users and trappers are literally forced to occupy the same areas as it is a valley, and there is much overlap between the two user groups. This has caused 9 dogs that I know of in the last 20 years to have encounters with traps and 1 child. The Safe Trails Committee submitted 5 proposals to the Board of Game last March that would have established 100-yard setbacks from specific trails, roads, campgrounds, beaches, and the Summit Lake Recreational Area. The only thing that passed was a 50-yard setback from campgrounds. It was a start. Whereas I know emotions and feelings are subjective and hard to measure, there has been an undercurrent of fear and concern that winter enthusiasts share when they're going out to ski, mountain bike, snowshoe, snow machine, etc. with their dogs. With this in mind and the support of a few others, the Cooper Landing Safe Trails Committee was established to address the issues. Our group formed to continue work started in 2013 after several dogs got trapped in this area and has since gained momentum and support, including the U.S. Forest Service and the Cooper Landing Advisory Planning Commission. Traps have been close enough to trails to catch the ski tip poles of 2 middle schoolers and would certainly be in reach of a ski tour dog on a lead. At the Russian Lakes trailhead, I ran into a group getting ready to winter fat tire bike with their loose dogs into the backcountry. I warned them of the possibility of traps along the trail, for which they were thankful. And then just weeks ago, I heard a comment that an active trap was indeed found along the trail just miles in. In the Our Values statement from the Forest Service, it says, managing for safety in every way, physical, psychological, and social. And their mission statement is to manage its lands to balance the short and long-term needs of people and nature by providing access to resources and experiences that promote economic, ecological, and social vitality, among other ways. We need the help of local government to achieve this. In 2020, the Safe Trails Committee did a survey to get a measure of how the community felt. 385 surveys were successfully delivered to P.O. boxes, businesses, and landowners. Out of these, we received 135 back, resulting in a 35% return rate, which by polling standards is considered good. We found over 90% wanted trap setbacks and some wanted 1 mile setbacks. We don't think this is reasonable, but what we heard loud and clear is that Cooper Landing wants safety in their community. Our survey had the same results of a survey done in 2015. 90% supported setbacks. The problem is not going away and needs addressing. Just recently, an avalanche close by claimed the life of a skier and required rescue dogs to help find the victim. The dog handler very courageously didn't hesitate to assist. But the underlying concern for local traps weighed heavy on her mind and the safety of her own beloved, well-trained search and rescue dog. A safer scenario can be achieved and allow for all user groups to have the benefit of wilderness in their rightful ways with an updated form of management. The Alaska Constitution requires the state to manage wildlife for the maximum benefit and use for all Alaskans, subject to preferences among beneficial users. I would like to see this management trickle down to the local level. There are precedents of trap setbacks in 15 Alaskan municipalities. Cooper Landing is not a municipality, but certainly has a core residential area and growing community, and most residents have dogs that they like to recreate with. The demographics are changing to a younger, more active population. Our winter visitor numbers and economy are expanding and will be so even more with the new bypass bringing more folks down to the Kenai Peninsula year-round. Local knowledge is the best resource to suggest and create local regulations. For a local municipality to study and bring up to date existing regulations that reflect the current state of affairs is crucial and critical. Times are changing, and so does the need to update or amend how things are regulated. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to share.
Thank you for your testimony this morning, Ms. Temple. Are there any questions? Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative Josephson. So, in a nutshell, if I'm getting this correct, this bill supports local governments to be able to have their own rules?
Through the chair, yes. And one thing I would note is that in Article 10 of our Constitution, relative to the subject of powers of local government, the founders in the mid-50s said that that priority should be liberally construed. So that's a powerful statement that I doubt we see in other places than the Constitution. So that's why we talk about the importance of local control a lot in this state.
Thank you, Representative Mears. When I said questions, I meant were there any questions for Ms. Temple? Oh, that's all right. Were there any questions for Ms. Temple? Okay, hearing none, we will move on then to Neeland Taylor. If you could state your name for the record, you begin your testimony.
Yes, I'm Neeland Taylor. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Please go right ahead.
I've lived and practiced law here in Anchorage, in Alaska, for 49 years, and I support House Bill 12. As a volunteer lobbyist, I've become very familiar with the jurisdictional issues addressed in House Bill 12. Among other things, I have prepared and filed a brief in the Alaska Supreme Court addressing municipal jurisdiction to enact public safety ordinances which limit the setting of traps within municipal boundaries. That pending case is in the Supreme Court and involves an ordinance enacted by the city of Valdez in 2005. That ordinance prohibits the setting of large traps in limited areas within the city limits of Valdez. In 2020, the Alaska Trappers Association and the National Trappers Association sued the city of Valdez, asking for a court order invalidating Valdez's ordinance on the grounds that it had no jurisdiction to enact any ordinance having anything to do with trapping. The Superior Court in Valdez held for the city and held that the city does have jurisdiction and that the ordinance is valid. The two trappers associations appealed to the Alaska Supreme Court, and that issue is on appeal. Oral argument was held in January 2022, and the Supreme Court's website indicates that a draft opinion is being circulated, but we have no opinion yet. The State Department of Law prepared an amicus brief. Well, let me go back just a second. They tried to join the litigation, but they were late, and the Superior Court did not allow the state to participate as a party, but the state has filed an amicus brief in that appeal. And in the amicus brief, the state supports the two trappers associations. I am confident that the Supreme Court will hold that Valdez has the jurisdiction and that the ordinance is valid. 12, actually, I just heard it's 15, but at any rate, I am aware of 12 municipalities that have enacted public safety ordinances which regulate trapping within the municipality boundaries. And they regulate them to only a limited extent. And I refer to Juneau, Skagway, Cordova, Valdez, Seward, Homer, Soldotna, Kenai, Anchorage, Nome, Fairbanks, and the Matsu Borough. The first of these were Fairbanks and Seward, and I believe that Fairbanks enacted its ordinance in 1960. Seward enacted its ordinance in the 1990s. All of these, with the exception of the Matsu Borough, are home rule. And I, as I just said, I believe that the Supreme Court will uphold the right of a home rule municipality to enact a limited public safety ordinance regarding trapping. Second and third class municipalities. Let me be more clear. First, second, and third class cities. Actually, I think there's only two classes of cities. And first, second, and third class boroughs have the statutory authority to enact ordinances that impact trapping or provide for no trapping in school playgrounds, on school grounds, and in local public parks. But the state of Alaska takes the position that they do not have that authority. So we have a conflict, and so citizens going to a municipal government, whether it's a borough or a city, and proposing to their assembly that they have an ordinance that protects or prohibits trapping on school property, on a small public park, et cetera, there's a conflict. Otherwise, the Department of Fish and Game is saying they have no jurisdiction, and others, for instance, me, are saying that they do have the jurisdiction to do it. So a bill is needed, this bill, to provide clarity. And briefly, I just think that clarity is a really good idea. This bill is needed. Some commonly used traps in Alaska can quickly kill small children and often do kill dogs. I speak of large conibear traps. For those of you who are interested or know about trapping, and also large leg hold traps can maim and kill dogs and present a danger to small children too. Thousands of public places all over Alaska are inappropriate for setting these kinds of traps, and local government is best equipped to identify these places. I have tried in the Matsu Borough and other areas to prepare lists of places where there are no traps or where there should be setbacks and where traps should not be set, or large traps should not be set. And it is an impossible job, really, to come up with all those places. But local assemblies can. And so that's why this is a good idea, or why I strongly support it. The Department of Fish and Game and the Board of Game simply are not equipped to deal with all of these places all over the state. Finally, House Bill 12 does not require municipalities to enact ordinances. It's up to each municipality listed in the bill whether to use their jurisdiction. And once again, you know, the idea here is public safety. We're not talking about, and I'm not advocating for management of game populations by municipalities. We're talking about limited public safety ordinances. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Mr. Taylor. Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Taylor this morning? Hearing none, are there any further questions for the bill sponsor, Representative Josephson? Representative Baker, please go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Representative Josephson, in drafting of this bill and in consultation, were there any municipalities that specifically do not have the ability at this time to manage this that reached out to your office or that you consulted with that said this was an issue?
Through the chair, the answer is no. The municipality of Anchorage in the last few years has, I would say, enhanced, or what's a better word? It has asserted more authority over regulation of trapping, including in Chugach State Park, as I understand it. So that creates an interesting dichotomy, right? Because we're talking state park land that is overlain by a municipal government. And we see that all the time, including right out the street when you get into the Tongass. But no, there's been no one who's come to me recently from local government to ask for this.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with that, does it seem like there are, other than those municipalities that have already exercised their ability to manage this, have you found, your office found, that there's anywhere that this is also an issue in different parts of the state that may not be able to manage this at this time without this legislation?
Through the chair, I would say that the answer is yes. So the result of this case would be applicable statewide. That's number one. And so all of these 14 or 15 other communities besides Valdez would be impacted. In my own reading in the media and talking to advocates of this reform, we know that the issue arises all the time. So this sort of user conflict arises all the time. And it arises on the Kenai Peninsula, absolutely, in the Kenai and Soldotna areas, in the Mat-Su. It was front and center, as I said, in the 2017 time period. So the issue isn't going away. And if anything, the list of communities that want to take affirmative action is growing. It's not receding. So I don't know if I can tell you a whole lot more than that.
Follow up, Representative Baker.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair McCabe.
Thanks. So I have a couple questions, Representative Josephson. How many dogs or cats do you, I'm sure you did the research on this just because you probably knew it was coming, but how many dogs and cats are killed by vehicles every year in Anchorage, say, or the Mat-Su?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I did not research how many dogs and cats are killed by cars.
Okay. So we know, we've been seeing in the news the snowmobile versus sled dogs that were unfortunately killed. And I have three dogs and a bunch of chickens and other animals, so I'm pretty aware. But even though I live out in the woods, my dogs are always on a leash for this reason. So I think the problem is exactly what you just stated a minute ago, is that Anchorage has sort of extended their reach into Chugach State Park. So dogs don't really honor any kind of boundaries. And if you are out ski-joring or cross-country skiing on the boundary between Anchorage and the Chugach State Park, and the dog goes across the boundary, could be a couple inches outside the city limits and gets caught in a trap, that this is part of the problem that we deal with, is the dogs don't know what the boundaries are. And if the owner doesn't have control of them and doesn't have sight of them, it sort of becomes a problem. So I'm struggling with this one, truthfully. I feel for the animal owners and the pets, for sure, just like I feel for the pets that I see on the side of the road. Mm-hmm. That are killed by a car, and I don't blame the pet. I blame the owner, because the pet's not under their control. So I don't know. This is going to be a tough one for me.
Okay. Just as the comments, just to be clear, the municipality of Anchorage, every bit overlays much, not, I don't think all, but much of Chugach State Park, just as if you were in downtown Anchorage. It's sort of presumptive authority as a municipality extends and overlays those borders. So there's nothing about moving into the park from what would otherwise be an urban area that changes that necessarily, except that the park would have its own sets of regulations. It's true that dogs don't know boundaries, but that's part of, I think, why a municipality might say, we want to invite people to have them off leash. And we think that's a privilege people should have without having to worry about their dogs getting caught in traps. So the other thing that your comment raises, and this is what's troubling, I think, to local governments about traps, is they sort of occupy the field. I don't mean this legally, I mean literally. So when they're there, they send a message to others be exceedingly careful or just don't come visit this area. And you may say that, understandably, that that's a little bit exaggerated. But they you know, for example, it strikes me that a 50 or 100-foot setback is not burdensome. It may be burdensome on a disabled trapper, but it's not burdensome, I think. And I think the local governments that regulate it and ask for that share that belief.
Follow up, Vice Chair McCabe.
So thanks. And one more through the chair. One more question. So Department of Fish and Game in the bill, it says Department of Fish and nothing prevents the Department of Fish and Game from exercising its powers to manage the state's fish and wildlife. So if there's a infestation of, say, muskrats in one of the little in the lake down by the university, maybe, and you would then Fish and Game could contract with a local trapper to reduce the infestation of muskrats, and that would be okay under the bill.
Through the chair, yes, and that's also spelled out on page 1 at lines 9 and 10, where it speaks to municipalities offering exemptions. And that's sort of what's implied there. Yeah. But no, I think the answer is, I say no. Yes, you're correct that Department of Fish and Game could take those measures.
Thanks.
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you, through the chair. Representative Josephson, I think a real world example of this is Grubby down in Homer and the offspring of Grubby needing to be caught and dealt with. My question has to do with where trappers can trap. So how much of Alaska is available to someone who wants to trap?
Through the chair, Representative Hemshute, I suspect it exceeds 99%. But I don't know for sure. But it is a vast part of the state.
So follow up?
Well,
thank you. Through the chair. So in your estimation, allowing municipalities to govern themselves and set aside areas free from trapping for the enjoyment of families with children who may go off trail or animals that may go off trail would have a fairly minimal impact on the ability of trappers to exercise their economic activity of trapping.
Through the chair, Representative Hemshute, I agree completely with that. And in fact, that's talked about in the legal briefs, that the state and the trappers don't really make the case that their objectives through the Board of Game are in any way seriously impeded. I think this is just a brewing struggle between these two camps.
Follow up?
No, thanks.
Are there any further questions for Representative Josephson? One comment I will make. The reason I was interested in bringing this forward is I remember when I was an aspiring 23-year-old city council member, I believe it's now Mayor Mark Springer, brought up just really not really with saying, you know, we should do this or that, but just brought up the notion of whether or not we should regulate trapping in our community. I think it is a growing concern just from things that I've gleaned from Facebook and so on. And so I would just like to articulate that I think there is interest, at least from Bethel, in taking hold of this. And that is kind of why I wanted to bring this forward, because I do think there is applicability to rural Alaska here as well. So with that aside, Representative Josephson, if you had any closing remarks.
Mr. Chair, I don't. I know that this is a contentious issue. I respect everyone's opinion. And I appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you very much for your presentation. The Community and Regional Affairs Committee will meet again on March 14th at 8 a.m. The time is 9:53 a.m. and this hearing of the Community and Regional Affairs Committee is now adjourned.